The theme for the afternoon talk is the exploration of conditions, endeavor. Louder? Yes, sure. I'll get closer. The theme. Afternoon talk is the exploration of conditions, and I'll try to give some practical explanation here of what I mean by the theme. Yesterday evening in the inquiry, we touched very briefly on the initial anguish, might say, of Gotama, and how that compelled him to leave wife and family, duty and responsibilities, and to take on another order of responsibility, what's called the seeker, the spiritual search, the quest. And in India at that time, and there is a vast reservoir of literature from that period, that in India of that time, there was a tremendous diversity of exploration. And that showed itself in a whole variety of teachers, teachings, sadhus, swamis, and yogis, and various expressions of realization and discovery, plus a very long religious tradition that reflecting itself in the yatras, in the places of pilgrimage, and of course Varanasi as the oldest place of pilgrimage in the world, running back for thousands of years, was a major focal point in all of that area. And when the Buddha left home and went on this journey for some 6 years, underwent, as it's recorded, a whole range and variety of rather austere and somewhat self-punishing practices, exercises, fasting, and discipline. And during the period of time, he had a meeting with two teachers, one Alara and the other Udika. And with the two teachers that he met, he had very deep, and this is important here, very profound, we might call mystical or spiritual experiences. And in the description to his teachers about these experiences, they said to him, look, this is what we are pointing to. This is the ultimate truth. This is the Godhead. This is liberation. This is enlightenment. And due to those experiences, they said to him, you are now ready to teach. You are ready now to teach this Dharma because you have had the most profound and the most liberating experience which is available. And we want you to share your experience with others, to give teachings to others. But the Buddha, or more precisely then, Gotama, had a concern in his mind, and it's a concern which should address all of us. And that concern was, how is it that I can have these very profound experiences in meditation, in solitude, or in nature, then the experience ends, and when it ends, I'm back into my normal consciousness, I'm back into the everyday world, and then I have to deal with this everyday world, and then hopefully, through the disciplines, or through skill, or through the meditations, I can then enter back into these very profound experiences. And this duality, this separation of profound mystical experience from the ordinary and the everyday, troubled him. It troubled him enough that he refused the invitation to start teaching, and he felt that this separation of the profound from the profane, from the deep, from the mundane, troubled him enough that he decided to leave his teachers and go his own way and find out. Is it possible, very profound question, is it possible that there is no gap? Is it possible that the most profound and the most ordinary have a meeting place? And that was the urge. That was the quest. That was what was to find out. Sometimes, and some of you, some of us, we may also have that view. Sometimes we have that view in a rather everyday way. We go and retreat, and then we have some experiences on the retreat. We feel, hopefully, some benefit and perhaps some depth. And then the question arises, after the retreat, when I leave here, how do I apply? How do I keep what I've learned? So there's already a gap in the thinking. Some of you may have had experiences with us, naturally occurring, or through practices and approaches, or through other meditations and disciplines there. And one felt, wow, that was so deep, and that was very profound. It may well have been, but as Gautama found out, it just lasted a short period. Then once again, one is dealing with everyday life, and there feels to be a gap between one experience and the other. And one wonders, as the Gautama wondered, where is the bridging of the gap? And it's a deep and important question for any human being to ask and to discover and to find out actually if it is possible. If it is possible, one has to be, I would say, rather unusually free in the first place. And what I mean by that voice is that there are many voices outwardly of ourselves, voices of authority here, and the inner voices of authority, and the combination of the two voices together actually can easily be our own coffin. It's the imprisonment of the freedom of the spirit. And somehow the release of that, just like releasing a bird from the cage, just like releasing the chicken from its shell, that if we're to discover, if we're to realize and find out, it will require from us a great deal of letting go, a great deal of renunciation and giving up, and making and establishing for us, as we endeavor to do here, some real fresh priorities. And that's an enormous challenge, and I'll touch upon some of the conditions for that in a moment. And as you kind of, hopefully, settle in a little bit, you'll hear from us, that is the three of us here, various kind of features or small aspects of the conditions, of things to be mindful and aware of. And one of the things which the Gautama realized after the night of awakening under the Bodhi tree, first thing, and one has to remember in all of this, is that the guy has done a heck of a lot of practices, has had a lot of profound spiritual and mystical experiences, all of which, without exception, are available in what the teachings are offered here, has journeyed into a very deep place inside of himself. And out of the realizations that came that night, one might have thought he was going to be overwhelmingly full of compassion. He touched a very deep place in the heart. His heart has opened up. He's seen that the problem that human beings are in. And then the thought arose in his mind, as is recorded, He said, I'm not sure, I'm putting it into contemporary English, I'm not sure whether it's actually worth teaching what I have to say. Because human beings simply won't understand. They won't understand. And he engaged something which some of us, I especially, love very much. He engaged in a radical, dramatic alteration of human priorities. Absolutely dramatic. And this, he felt, human beings could not understand. And the first thing that he did was he completely threw out religion. Though these Buddha images have crept in like fungus, they have crept in over 2,500 years, but he threw out religion. And this throwing out of religion was to throw out the rituals, the ceremonies, the vows, the observances, the mantras, the candles, the flowers, the incense, the temples, the whole guru setup, the belief in the prophets, the avatars, the incarnation and God. It all went, a lot of it, out. And he said, in religious India, he's going to listen to me. That language is not in there. All of it went out. But he didn't make it any more comfortable for the secularists. You know, sometimes in this country it's divided up, isn't it, between Tel Aviv and the other place. He didn't make it any more comfortable for the secularists either, because the secularists are as strong believers. Don't think secularism is free from belief systems. It's a very strong belief system. That's right, Tel Aviv. Apologies for your error. And what are the values and the belief systems in secularism? Very strong. The belief often in secularism is the purpose of life is to become somebody important, one. Secondly, to have possessions and knowledge, two. And third, to have some kind of authority position. It's secular life is the consistent affirmation again and again of I, me, and my. And this secularism, that's a strong feature in the culture, creeps in everywhere, even where some fine and noble work is being engaged in, not to underestimate how strong what I want, the money I want, the position I want, the influence I want, and who I want to be. And it's not unusual for men and women to be either completely trapped in one, the religion, completely trapped in the other, secularism, and to be told either way, this is what it's all about. This is the purpose of life. This is the reason for existence. And some people, plenty of people, try to find the bridge between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, between religion and secularism, kind of mix the two together. Have both. Happy life and a happy eternal life. Whatever. The Buddha threw out both. That leaves all of us rather naked. Either we run on one set of beliefs, and if religion made us really happy, then we'd be really happy in religion. Is that the case? Secularism made us really happy. Why do we have so many depressed, unhappy, neurotic and addicted people? Something is amiss. And from that kind of view, this is where the difficulty and the challenge comes in. If I'm willing to question, I'm willing to engage in inquiry could there be not a loyalty to one or a loyalty to another, not an integration of both, which is a common cultural phenomena? Could I be free enough to find a middle way, another way in life, which is not really addicted or holding or believing in either? Could I find a middle way? And that was the challenge. And that's going to really mean that men and women are really going to have to dig very deeply with this. And we don't have to say, or try to become missionaries and convert others. It's the Dharma for questioning people. And the Dharma of questioning people doesn't offer too comfortably a kind of nice, neat prescription. It'd be lovely if it did. It doesn't give answers so easily. But there's a certain trust that if you and I dig deep inside, and if we are willing to raise the questions, we may bring out something out of the being which has been hidden for a long time, either by religion or by secularism. We may bring something else out. And the preciousness and the beauty of human beings, it's phenomenal potential, rarely used, but phenomenal. So after coming out away from the tree of awakening, what you hear from us and from other teachers, the Buddha found it rather helpful and useful to look into or to form certain small groups. If you take secular culture, it refers to something to be really mindful about. You will see it arising, and I will see it arising perhaps in our meditations in our day. It referred to 8 worldly conditions. And years and years ago, just reading and hearing from one of my teachers about the 8 worldly conditions. And wow, did it ring some bells with me? How the life, your life, possibility, your entire life, could be in the grip, a grip of those 8 worldly conditions. And there are 4 pairs of opposite. One pair, success and failure. How much attention in the inner life, thought, feeling, views and opinion is given around success and failure? I'm succeeding, I'm not succeeding, I don't know the hell whether I'm succeeding or whether I'm not succeeding, etc. Success and failure. It's a strong value in the kind of society in which we live. And wherever there is success, there will have to be failures. And we live in the torment. And even those who are successful, sometimes we look at their lives, and as one of the master poets said, I went to see a concert last year, Bob Dylan, success ain't no success at all. And Dharma and I, we say, that's success, give me failure. The other, gain and loss. Gain and loss. How much emotion, story, goes around having and not having? How many conversations do you and I have about having and not having? Having and not having enough money. Having and not having a relationship. Having and not having goods. Having and not having a job. Gain and loss. Having and losing. How much time, preoccupation, how much it rather can consume our life. To the point we think life is just about that. Success and failure, gain and loss. Another one, great tormentor of the life. Praise and blame. Oh, merciless it is. And how often it is that sometimes the ones who praise us the most blame us the most. Think of your parents. Not all right. Etc. And so sometimes the ones who loved us, who have said the most sweetest, beautiful thing, who have expressed their divine, erotic, passionate, tantric closeness. Get the point. And a few days, weeks or months, the love of one's life becomes the hate of one's life. The one who meant everything now means nothing. Praise and blame. And it can consume, like the other pairings, it consumes attention. It consumes the mind. And because we are all talking about it, praise and blame, gain and loss, success and failure, because we're talking about it, we've built up all the stories. And we then think all these stories, with all of this and the other pair, which is pleasure and pain, we build up all these stories and we think that's the reality. We think that's what life is all about. Oh, no, it ain't. We've made this up. We've contributed this. What would it be if we had a little realization? Where would we be if we say, let me just lay quietly the world of success and failure. Let the world of praise and blame be quiet. Gain and loss. Having or not having, same thing. The constant pursuit of pleasure, of comfort, and the avoidance and the running away from the discomfort or the pains of life. What would it be if all those 8 worldly conditions, those 4 pairs, we say, let that be quiet within the being. Let me have a little space around that. Let me say these are just values, culture values, secular values, what our politicians have told us, what our educators have told us, what our parents have told us, what we are telling ourselves matters. Say, maybe that really doesn't matter as much as I believe, as I have been told, and as I think. Then where are we? Then who are we? Then what is it to be a human being? No religion, no 8 worldly conditions. Whoa. Now we're in a little bit of an unknown. Great. Great. Now we're in a new area. And in that new area, it's going to need some conditions. It's going to need some support somewhere. We're terrified of the unknown. All of the anxiety which people experience, it's the terror of the unknown. I don't know what will happen. I don't know how it will work out. I don't know what the result will be. And because we have so find it so hard to live with the unknown, we have to fill that space up. The lack of trust in the unknown, the lack of love for it, one of the great loves of life, if we really understood it properly, that we would love to be with the unknown. And if we begin to love that feeling of the unknown, to feel that human beings, sometimes we are at our best when we're insecure. Sometimes in our insecurity, sometimes it brings something fresh out of us. And the Dharma challenge is learning, not easy. It's the cliff walk, to walk the edge. Sometimes out of that, whoa, beautiful things come. Trouble is, we damn well mad for security. Mad for it. Religion would give us security. Give us consolation. Which sometimes is not a bad thing, I have to say. I see my mother, I have to bring in the mother, who is more Catholic than that German Pope. And in a few days' time, don't let me forget to ring. My mum is 90. And a week or two ago, she's in one of these old people's homes. I think she's one of the oldest in there. So they dressed her up. I thought it was rather sweet. As the Queen of England, and gave her a throne. And a crown on her head and a nice set of robes. She loved it. Loved it. And when I talk to my mother, she doesn't like to hear the word death. She's not very Buddhist. And when I talk to her about these things. The beautiful thing for her, that her faith in her God, and her faith in the church, and her faith in Jesus, and her faith in prayers, etc. It gives her a feeling of trust. Gives her the feeling that when she dies, she will be back with my father. It's rather odd because they argued their whole life, but anyway, all is forgiven when they die. And religion gives people, gives the heart, which I think is precious and important, which science is robbing religious people of. It gives the heart some feeling of consolation and love and understanding in a non-intellectual kind of way. And religion and many other aspects of it do feel as a very valuable and important part to play, as much to appreciate in secular culture. But this afternoon, please forgive me slagging both of them. Just to free us up. You can see the virtues of both. To free us up, to say, what is it when I have nothing to rely upon? I don't have any real security there. What then do I do? What are the kind of conditions? What do I need to be receptive to? And it's at this point that the Buddha's Dharma of the Middle Way begins to enter into the dialogue. It's part of the discourse. And so, as I say, when you're listening to us, you will hear some of the small groups, and some have been mentioned. So at the beginning, Iran spoke to us of the three jewels of awakening, the jewel of the Dharma, contribution to waking us up through looking at conditions. What are the conditions that make events happen? What are the conditions that change events? The conditions have to be there for an event to arise. If any of the conditions are changing, the event stops. Repeat. All the Dharma teachings rest on this central point, and the Buddha said it's very hard for people, it will be very hard for them to understand this. Because we want comfort. We want something to believe in. We want whatever. When the conditions are there, an event can arise. The event could be the state of mind. The event could be the condition of the body. The event could be being with another. The event could be a retreat or whatever, all the million things. When the conditions are there, the event can arise. When the conditions change and become something else, the event stops. All Dharma teachings rest on this simple truth. It's called dependent arising, the dependent arising of conditions. And he says, the middle way is the human being's exploration of this simple truth. To explore this, the whole being to explore it. Why? Why? It's very hard to dispute it. Very hard. Can anybody think of any event in your life or my life, at anywhere, at any time, which does, has not and does not require conditions for its presence? No. Can anybody think of any event ever, in the, not only in the entire history of humanity, but in the entire history, something to arise, the conditions must be there for it to arise? End of story. All Dharma teachings are on this simple truth and realization. Quite something to contemplate, to meditate on, to explore. And all the rest, sitting cross-legged, standing and walking, hearing Christopher ramble on, whatever it might be, it kind of weaves its way around this core truth, this core principle. This arises because the conditions are there for it to arise. Conditions stop, conditions, events stop, etc. And even if it would only take one small change in the condition and the event for a person here or elsewhere could stop. Take a small example of what I mean. Over the years, different places of being a small servant of the Dharma, the message has been passed over to me of some crisis, or death, or loss, tragedy, or whatever. And I've had to report that to the person and pass the information over, and that person, within the hour, has had to go. They've had to attend to something very serious and very dramatic and had to go. Sometimes in the same country, in India, sometimes it's been straight to the airport and straight back home, crisis. Yeah. In other words, how many conditions are supported in this example for us to actually be here in this situation, in this event? Countless situations. It includes your intention, of course it does. It includes my intention, of course it does, and our intention. But it also includes many things to make it possible which are known and unknown in the condition. The condition arising make for the event. Change the condition, it changes the event. The profound principle, as I mentioned. And the principle of that is actually precious and beautiful, because if it's explored and understood, some of the situations you and I find ourselves in, the event is a little bit, could say, like a house of cards. You say, why am I like this? Why am I going through this? What's happening to me? Etc. And we can speculate till the cows come home, till the holy cows come home, about why I'm feeling like I'm feeling, why I'm thinking like I'm thinking. But sometimes it just takes one change, like a house of cards, the whole thing collapses. whole thing about it. And we're interested in looking at the conditions to see the conditions which make for a real change. And it's so important that it applies personally, it applies socially, it applies religiously, it applies politically, it applies to the nation state. What are the situations that make for the change? And as the Buddha pointed out, the application of looking into the conditions to see what the change is in order to free us up. It's in order to liberate us. It's in order to wake us up. It's in order to bring the best out of the human being. And that's the deep interest. And for that, we genuinely need each other. With the Buddha sitting under the tree there, that the realization, that means making real, in this radical voice of that comes through again and again in different ways, that the hub of the teachings, as I was just explaining, also and explores the human condition. And one aspect of the human condition is that life has in it problems. Stress, unhappiness, anxiety, suffering, unsatisfactoriness, many, many expressions of it. But nowhere has the Buddha ever said life is suffering. It doesn't appear in the text. This is the propaganda, mostly by depressed Buddhists, putting out the word the last cup. There's no such. Not in a teaching which emphasizes so much about happiness, about joy, about appreciation, about gratitude, about kindness, about love and care and respect and sensitivity and generosity and giving and sharing. That language runs through the teaching as expressions of a mature and adult human being. Sometimes all of that kind of gets put aside as though, you know, life is suffering and trying to get on with it. That view is amongst the views which need to be looked at. What is the condition which is contributing to a painful view? What is the condition or conditions that's contributing to my judgmental mind? To my being reactive. If the conditions change, that mindset also changes. And that's when you know it. The proof of the pudding, as we say in English, is in the eating of it. That, you know, sometimes we say, oh, I know why I'm miserable. Or I know why I'm feeling depressed. I've been on the retreats, I've been in therapy, I've been on the couch with the analyst, not literally. You know what I mean. Etc. And I know why I'm like I am. In Dharma, if one knows, the problem has stopped. If one's got an intellectual, conceptual, I know why I'm like I am, and it's not making any difference. You don't know. To know and to see is to change. We know when it's finished. We know when the condition has changed and we're not, and the condition or condition is not forming the event any longer. And it's the proof of the pudding is in the experience. And sometimes you and I, we've had our events in our day-to-day life. We've been really challenged by them. We have wondered, what on earth is going to change this? You know, what a terrible situation to find myself in. And nothing seems to be working for me. And it gets very easy in human that the view of despair enters into the situation. And then sometimes, almost as a surprise to ourselves, something comes out of ourself and we see it differently. We talk to another, it might be a good friend, partner, or professional, or whatever. We talk to someone and she or he or they shed light. And suddenly, we're looking afresh. We're seeing the same situation. The event hasn't changed. Something has changed. And the condition which was causing our anguish, causing our despair, our judgmental view, that condition has changed. It's gone out of the picture. It's gone out of the story. The story may be the same, but the perception of it has changed. And it's the perception of the event is always more important than the event. We are giving, as human beings, far too much importance to the event. The event is important. It is important not to underestimate the importance of the event. But if I identify with the event, if I grasp onto the event, whatever it may be, past, present or future, whatever it may be, at some point, the event becomes problematic. We grasp the event. And we're trying to say, life is events. Life is story. Life is an unfolding process of conditions. That's what it is to be alive, to be human in this world. But I have the power of consciousness. I have the capacity to perceive. I have the capacity to look at. There is the potential for change. I may not be able to change the event, but I might be able to change the way of looking at it. So the event ceases to be a problem. And when it ceases to be a problem, love will come. Love will come. And that is the liberating force of love. But sometimes I marvel, and I'm sure you do, sometimes we, in the world of the Buddha, more than 100% in agreement. The Buddha said, the world isn't just inhabited with men, women, children, animals, and sentient beings. He says, the world is inhabited with gods and angels and Asuras and so forth. And I say to that, hallelujah, absolutely, absolutely. And Asuras, you know, one of those Buddhist words. The gods and the goddesses are the goddesses, and the angel, a very pure being, and the Asuras are the dark forces, usually called prime ministers and presidents. No, very bad joke, sorry, but it might do. Where there's violence, there's the dark force. Where there's subscription to violence, there's the dark force. And so the world is inhabited with human beings, but also it is inhabited with the gods and the goddesses and the angels. And the way I understand that is we tend very easily to identify each other by the physical. Look at you, say, oh, you're a man and you're a woman. I'm a man. We say, this is who you are. You're a human. You're a human being. But in the Dharma of Exploration, we make acknowledgement for that in a relative way, but actually we're much more deeply interested in what is present, what shows itself from within. And this is where the gods and the goddesses and the angels and the Asuras come through. And sometimes you and I, we sometimes we have the privilege, it is a privilege, sometimes we meet extraordinary extraordinary human being, but they're actually not human. Human beings are involved in religion and secularism, which is rather mundane. And the gods and the goddesses, they have a transcendent element about them. Nelson Mandela, one of the gods of the earth, and the Dalai Lama, the gods of the earth, and the Aung San Suu Kyi, you know, they're some of the bigger gods of the earth. But they're also the gods of the earth, and just sometimes we meet people, and there is some love and presence and steadiness about them. And these are our gods. And we need to contact with such gods there, because they speak of something which transcends the ordinary. It transcends religious belief system, and it transcends secularism and being a successful person. And they show that sense of the heart. And they are the gods and goddesses there, and they are incredibly important people. And when you and I have the privilege of having contact with, do associate, do connect with. We can learn love, inspire, be inspired by that. And sometimes we meet angels as well. And there's some new women and men who genuinely are angels. You know, they're pure, they're very unassuming, they're quiet, not a lot of ego going on, and living very sensitive and gentle lives. And these people are often ignored, or overlooked, or forgotten, or hardly referred to, but they're angels. And we need the gods and the goddesses. We need the contact with the angels. We need all those beautiful forces that can really lift our spirit and help us learn. And all of that is part of this incredible world that we are living in. And it's a terrible pity if we define the world in a very limited way. It's an infinite realm that we are in, and it has infinite potential for us. And sometimes freeing ourselves up not only opens up our inner life, but it opens up the world as well. It opens up everything. We're not here for ourselves. We're here to see clearly. We're here to have a genuinely infinite sense of things. And all that's part of the exploration of the middle way. Hang in. Stay steady. The limitless and the infinite is very close at hand. May your beings see into the events of life. May your beings see the condition arising of events. May all beings abide with a profound and liberating love in all directions.